irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Dude, I missed your fades.
My fades?
Yeah.
I can't fade this thing anymore, so I just gave up.
Well, it look like you were running the Millennium Falcon over there.
Yeah, and I wasn't. There's two buttons you press.
How you been, man?
I'm just turning up my... There we go.
I haven't seen you in a little bit. Eddie.
I saw you
Eddie
last week.
Pence. Well, I saw you on Wednesday, but yeah. I haven't seen you in
years.
You've
seen me on Tuesday in a while.
Yeah.
I've been
How
busy.
How you been? Are you excited with football?
I was until Sunday, yeah.
Well, I'm the same way with USC football. We shit the bed.
You guys got hammered by Texas, right?
Dude, hammered by Texas, hammered by Stanford. So we're done. Our season.
That's why I don't like college football.
It sucks, yeah. But you know what? At least there's a playoff now, but not
yeah,
like
but there's only four
like
teams in it.
I know.
That's the point.
Sucks. I agree. You're not excited for the Redskins football this season?
I was after week one, and then week two,
But you still got plenty of time.
Yeah, because it's not college football season.
Yeah, you got like you got at least five more weeks.
We'll see how they play. We'll see.
I you know what? I got to tell you, you are a very dedicated fan because I get very frustrated when my teams lose after maybe two or three seasons. But you've had a lot of losing seasons, dude.
Yeah, but I also got three Super Bowls, so.
Well, bad. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I had a great childhood.
It'd be bad if you were a Cleveland Browns fan.
If you're a fan, you're a fan.
That's true.
I'm just watching.
You don't get stressed? Like I literally...
I used to when I was a kid, but then I grew up and became an adult and realized, I have no bearing on the outcome of this game.
Yeah, but it's tough. So, I guess just for me, it's like if I love a team, man, it's like you're there with them, and when you see them just not executing, it's one of the most frustrating things.
It is, but I've gotten to the point where I could like pull myself away from it to the point like, okay, I have no control over this. I'm just watching this happen.
So you're not screaming at the TV?
I get mad at it, but it's not like I'm not like.
So do you get mad more at the defense or like an interception, like a kind of like a fumble, stuff like that? Like
I get more upset at effort. If I see people, if I see no effort or something like that, or lack of focus, that's the stuff that drives me nuts.
I feel like when it comes to sports, especially football, when you don't have coverage on a play when there's a pass play, that drives me crazy.
Yeah, but
it's like that's your only thing that you have to do. You don't have to do
it. Yeah, but there's another side that's working, that's designing stuff to be what you're doing. So if you're out schemed, that's one thing. But if you're blowing something because you're just distracted or lack of focus or no discipline, that's different. But I don't know.
Well, you're a very elevated football fan because
I watch a lot of football. It's my favorite sport.
No, it's the best, and this is the time of year. But you know what? It's like we're in a rebuilding year with USC football, and even like my fantasy team kind of shit the bed this week just because you know you sub in people sometimes,
yeah.
And and one of my guys that was supposed to do well didn't do well. And one of my bench players I was supposed to be injured ended up doing great. And it's like
that's fantasy football.
It's just football. It's just sports in general. But yeah, man. Anyways, what else have you been up to, dude?
I don't know. A lot of shows and stuff. I don't know.
Man, you've been doing shows all over the country.
Yeah. Oh, what country?
Well, all over San Diego. You did some shows.
I did a couple in San Diego, a couple in like Laguna Beach area type stuff.
What were the clubs in Laguna and San Diego?
They were just bars, like wineries and stuff.
Well, that's still fun.
All right.
Did you do an hour or did you do like 15
just
minutes?
No, like 30 minutes or whatever.
30 minutes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Enough to make it almost worth the drive.
You know, I don't know if I've ever asked you this, but when you do a show, do you have like a 15-minute set, a 30-minute set, and an hour set?
No, if I'm doing like a headline hour set or 45-minute set, then I'll have it sort of like blocked out, chunked out. But like when I'm doing like 15 or 20 or whatever now, it's just...
You're just winging it?
Not winging it, but I know my material enough where I can just go up there and talk until I get the light, then I get off stage.
Did you see the Robin Williams documentary yet?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
It's good. Did you see the Gary Shandling documentary yet?
No, I haven't seen that either.
Man!
I don't watch a lot of TV.
Oh, man, but they're right up your alley.
I know they are. There's so much stuff out there that would be great for me to watch.
Both
never watch
documentaries
TV.
Are awesome. You'll definitely do.
I always feel like I'm laying there watching TV. I should be up doing something else.
See, I do it way late at night where it's like I've done a bunch of stuff, and then that's when I can, do my thing. But let's jump into our guests have just arrived. We have Heinz Kim and Matt Cullen. Say hello, gentlemen.
Howdy.
Hey.
Dude, that's loud.
I know it is, right? Our studio audience loves you guys. They're so excited. Well, you guys have been working on a cool project. Let's talk about this. Let's just jump right in. I know I'm going to mess this up, but it's about Aurora Borealis, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
And you've been working on it for how long?
Since 2012.
Wow.
And 6 years.
That's crazy.
6 years.
And it's a doc, right? It's a documentary?
It's a documentary, a process-oriented documentary, and it's also It's a study about, and also too about re-educating ourselves to the science and to the research that's involved with studying the auroras.
And how did you guys get involved with this?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So that it basically started with the phone call. And my colleague, Eric Adamsons, who unfortunately couldn't be here, he had called me and asked if I had ever seen the auroras firsthand, and I said no, and we started talking a little bit about, the auroras and what they would look like, and we had this crazy idea about going to Iceland and launching high-altitude balloons with whatever cameras we could get off the shelves.
Wow!
And it turned into, it literally just turned into this obsession.
So you're trying to send a camera into the Aurora Borealis,
right.
Basically,
and we didn't have any science back.
Right, you just had a balloon and a camera.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
let it go.
I was trained as a painter. But
had you know anything about the Aurora Borealis before you signed on to the project?
Not the specifics.
You were just like, oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah, but I definitely had immersed myself into it.
Right.
Prior to the trip, and also to the whole technological aspects and scientific conditions of launching a high-altitude balloon, which is not an easy task.
Yeah.
And so we attempted three launches and recovered all of them successfully,
wow.
Which is pretty...
That's probably more than you bargained for.
What was the altitude you got to?
I think we got probably to about 30 kilometers and...
What's that in American speak?
American speak. That's like about maybe just shy of 100,000 feet.
Okay, wow.
Yeah,
and where is the Aurora Borealis? Like, how high up do you have to go to get into it?
You have to go up 100 kilometers, which is somewhere around 60-something miles.
That's crazy.
And that's what they call the Kármán line. And but the auroras can go down that far, which is in the ionosphere, and then all the way up to about 1,300 kilometers.
But it's not always guaranteed that you'll see them, too, right?
So the auroras are, it's a constant. There's obviously conditions to be able to optically
view.
Like
if it's overcast, you won't be able to see.
Obviously that, as well as also to daylight versus night, full moon, and specific types of conditions that are dictated by the energy that is sent over from our sun, these charged particles, and how they interact with our magnetosphere is what dictates the intensity. And depending on the intensity, there's a lot of factors. And but depending on the intensity also too dictates the latitude of viewability of what they call the ovation within both poles, north and south.
And have you seen it all lit up, like as beautiful as it is in my imagination, or were you kind of disappointed the first couple times?
No, it's actually it scared the crap out of me.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I had never seen anything like it. When you see something like that firsthand, you're just really... Well, for me, it was very humbling to see so much insane amount of energy in this phenomenon and to have it so close to you, perceptively. And it was actually quite impressive. And what really... jogs my mind about that is, if you think about, historically speaking, very, very primitive cultures trying to explain in their words
what it is,
their right. technology in words as to how to describe what it is that they were experiencing.
Now, Iceland's like one of the highest percentages of seeing it. Mm-hmm. But I heard you can also see it in Alaska and other parts as well.
Yeah, so typically the ovation on average, from what I understand, is somewhere around between 63 to 72 north latitude, which is just shy of the Arctic Circle. And it really just depends a lot on the intensity of the energy that's coming from the sun to the speed, what they call the solar winds.
Is there a time of year?
Yeah, there are seasons for activity peaks.
It's about like 3 weeks or something like that, right? Or a month?
Well, so the most active times that from my... I'm not a scientist, but I just want to... I'm sure a lot of our colleagues are going to correct me, but I just do not want to get this wrong, but from what I understand, it's typically the best viewing times for North America or for within the Northern Hemisphere is around March,
right.
And also in October.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then obviously they're visible throughout the winters, from October through March. Given the sun,
there's no prediction as to, you can't really tell when it's going to show up, basically.
Oh, right? There's enough predictability models, and a lot of scientists have been researching this, and they've gotten really good data to allow for at least 3 days of predictability forecasting.
Is it the same time window for the Southern Hemisphere, too, or is it just...
Yes, that's
same,
correct.
Same time?
Yes.
Same time of year?
Yeah.
So it happens at both poles.
At the same time.
Uh-huh. Simultaneous. Okay.
But, of course, in the winter, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's dark.
Yeah.
And it's light in the Southern Hemisphere. You can't see it. Hemisphere, so you're not going to be able to see it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Down there, because it's...
It's light all the time, constantly.
Yeah. Matt, did you travel to Iceland too and see it?
No, but I did get to go to Alaska.
Wow.
And see it, and it was mind-boggling.
That's on my bucket list. It's been on my bucket list for a long
time. I
think
everyone should go see it. It broke me down. I couldn't stop saying wow.
Wow.
See, I was there in September in 2016. Mm-hmm. 2015, I was there, and it was very faint, so I got just a glimmer of what it could be. So I never really saw the full thing.
So it's awe-inspiring.
Yeah, I could barely make it out. I'm like, oh, this would be so much cooler if it was brighter.
Yeah.
It was just very dim, and I was like, oh.
Were the colors mostly green, or did you get like swirls of purple? And because I've heard there's sometimes a kaleidoscope of just crazy colors.
Yeah, so basically our ionosphere, and when there's charged particles engaging within the ionosphere from our sun, it's what they call the coupling from our magnetosphere interacting with our ionosphere at the poles, or within and around the poles. And there's all sorts of different gas molecules, oxygen, atomic oxygen, nitrogen, what have you, and those dictate the colors that you see, just like a fluorescent or a neon light.
Yeah, so the different different gases dictate the colors.
So the temperature would have some effect on this then, right?
Temperature actually does have the charge, what they call, I'm assuming, yes, it's the flux, the energy, intensity.
And there's no sound, right?
Well,
are there vibrations that you've measured and have been able
to? I unfortunately am not qualified to, but I could offer you my opinion is that from what I understand, there is some research to suggest that there is definitely audible frequencies
sound?
And whatnot, but very fine frequencies, And as a result of ion collision or energetic particle collisions, and you know the emissions that are coming in from our ionosphere.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
So, and how did you decide where you were going to launch your cameras from, like the different balloons?
Oh well, from Iceland, you know, we just didn't know enough. But there were some very interesting. Okay, so the high altitude ballooning back in 2012, 2013 was at its infancy for enthusiasts. And there were a couple very interesting accessible models that were available on websites, particularly from Cambridge University in the UK, and where they could actually do plots given wind, certain times of the day and whatnot, and tied in with Google Maps, so you could actually give you a pretty good simulation as far as the trajectory of the balloon and where it would fall. So it was actually, that was incredibly helpful. And we actually stuck up, we actually launched a, within our little payloads, along with the camera, were a couple radios and also to a smartphone and Android. And so at a certain point within the altitude, about 20,000 feet, GPS satellites wouldn't be transmitting. So we'd have to look into other means of, we're basically in the dark about right. 20,000 feet. And then we would get no data packets transmitting from our GPS locator.
Crazy.
And then when at 20,000 feet, it's coming back down. But, you know, you're looking at also, too, the distances, the curvature of the Earth, any type of mountains and or occlusions, so to speak, that would interfere with the transmission. So you'd have to revert to, like, cell phone towers that were local that you could pick up a signal.
That is gnarly. And how much footage did you get?
Oh, we got quite a bit of darkness.
Right. Well, that's a given.
I mean, if you take it into perspective, the at the time when we were launching these cameras that were available off the shelves, the technology has grown immensely. I mean, it has improved so much as far as the resolution, the sensitivity and whatnot. So, you know, what we were sticking up there at the time, it's so much better now. And so that's why I like also, too, a lot of the footage that we've been shooting in real time.
Wow.
We're not at a cusp right now where we can actually be able to capture real-time footage of such a low-light experience.
And what camera would you use for that? I don't even know. You couldn't use drones or anything because that is also operated with radio, right? Isn't it? Or Bluetooth? You don't have any of that.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, those are, you know, radio-operated. But at the time, we would just put in fresh batteries, hit record, put a heat pack in the styrofoam box.
Wow!
And you're talking about
launch it.
Yeah, you're talking about a flight off of a high altitude balloon that could last probably about 3 hours, 2 to 3 hours.
Wow!
That's if it got to apogee. So you're hoping that you had enough data. Space to record in there, and you had enough battery power.
And how did you know what settings to put the camera in to capture?
So we just played with it.
Wow, because you can't control it from up there. You're not getting a direct feedback to see, I got to open up the aperture or the stop or any of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. So so we were setting up video cameras.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it would do it automatically?
It would just hit record and just keep
and it would
free
just
run.
Do autofocus and all the auto.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was trial and error.
Yeah.
But, and you guys have known each other since high school, so how did you guys decide to start working on films together?
I got a call one day from Hines, and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing on this date?" "Yeah, I got nothing." "Why, what's up?" He's like, "I'm coming to L.A., and we're going to go out into the desert and watch a bunch of amateur rocketry people launch some rockets." Okay, yeah, I like the desert, I like camping. Rockets, that sounds good.
Joshua Tree, did you go to Joshua Tree?
It's actually, I guess, Apple Valley?
Lucerne.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Lucerne.
Yeah.
And so we went out there, and that's when I learned about this crazy thing he had been working on. He was keeping the project pretty close to the vest. I was like, okay, I'm hooked. What else you got? What else are we doing?
You just said, come on this adventure with me and just see what happens. And there's no guarantee we'll get results, but let's roll the dice.
Pretty much. And then he started, telling me more about what the vision was. I've just been on board ever since.
So let's get into the vision of this a little bit. So what is the vision of this? What's the story? And I know it's still kind of coming together, but as far as what you're piecing together, what's the narrative of the movie?
Well, I was formerly trained as a painter, and I had no formal science engineering education in my background. But I do feel very interested in the fact of how we today in our society, how we can access information to reskill ourselves. And it's funny when you're provided with a opportunity or an insight that stirs curiosity. And this basically stirred my curiosity pretty heavily, this subject matter. And when we went to Iceland, myself and Eric, and met up with our colleague Samuel Hjaltalin, who is in Iceland, we didn't have any intention of making a movie. We didn't have any intention of basically making Bifrost. We were just curious. And for that, it's upon reflection, you think about, wow, people of our age, how is it that they can actually probably relate to us and to basically see the footage that we could provide them with the narrative of the process of what we went through and how much of a commitment and sacrifice that we're going through.
Yeah.
In order to purely just be able to see what's up there, this phenomenon that rarely anyone on this planet has ever seen with their own eyes. I mean,
well,
arguably less than 10% of the populace.
Oh, I'd say way less than 10, yeah. Maybe less than 3.
So I think a lot has to do with basically providing this process orientation towards the curiosity that and where it could stem for perhaps providing a binding element to introduce the public to the fascination of science and also to information that's grounded on science. And to share our excitement in an exploration.
Yeah, and to his point, only so many people have ever seen it, but most of them have seen it from the ground, from the Earth, and right. Then a few people have seen it from space, looking down, right? Or with video shot from space. It's never been imaged
from inside of it. Yeah.
So that was another thing that I just got. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This has never been done. I'm on board.
Yeah.
That's enough to say yes.
It's enough to say yes.
Until you're freezing in the middle of the night waiting for this thing to show up.
Well, yeah.
And you know what? We're still doing it.
Yeah. We got many more years of that, apparently. But that exploration, that curiosity, how many things can humans say haven't been explored yet?
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom of the ocean, maybe. But this is one of them. And the fact that, my friend has set himself on this path and given me this opportunity to be part of it, I was like, yeah, let's do this.
That's incredible. Eddie, I'm sure you got some questions.
Where are you guys at in the process of everything? You've been doing it since 2012. Are you guys 50% there, 80% there, or you got 20%?
It's hard to quantify.
Right.
Because there's, well, you know, we're working with several universities.
Right.
And particularly with the University of Puerto Rico. And just an incredible, talented, hardworking group of students in this program. I mean, I have to tell you, the level of professionalism and just sheer grit to get things done is just insane.
Well, the execution is like 90% of this.
Oh, yeah. And also, too, a lot of it has to do with basically trust on that level of having provide. Well, you know, I mean, we had to solicit our idea when my colleague Eric had first met with the principal investigator, what we call the PI, with the University of Puerto Rico, that was on helm with this educational project that was sponsored by NASA and the RockSat-X entity, which is basically a part of the NASA space grant. And so we told them of our interest, and they've been flying their experimental payloads with NASA for the past 11 years.
Wow.
So they have a track record. Now, this group is, the RockSat-X group is basically helmed by the Colorado Space Grant Consortium. And they there's several universities that solicit proposals in order to be able to get a space on that rocket that launches from Wallops Flight Facility in Wallops Island, Virginia. And six payloads, six sub-payload sections, and variety of experiments. And it's a very, very competitive, very sought-after flight. And they do these once a year. We basically have been piggybacking with the University of Puerto Rico and partnering with them, providing them cameras in order to test them, to make sure that what we can, the hardware that we can obtain, consumer level, would actually work in such conditions. I mean, we're talking about a rocket, and that's a lot of force.
What is it? Is it like, how many Gs?
On average, well, it's tested up to 20 Gs.
20. Mass.
Yeah.
So, but, you know,
a lot of force.
We're talking
there.
About intermittent. Yeah. Yeah. So it's very challenging engineering wise. And
what camera can sustain that?
Well, so far we've flown Leica cameras off the shelf, and we've flown a couple other cameras, but they are robust and resilient. No issues on that level.
I would think the lenses are the most fragile part of it.
Yeah, and they hold up.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's impressive.
Yeah. So it's been very interesting. And then, so from there, we continue flying our cameras with them, and also to associating ourselves with the other scientists that are awarded flights and launch their research, their experiments, and their instruments into the auroras.
What kind of experiments are they doing with this?
Whoa. So I guess I could break it down to all sorts of different types, particularly to understand the behavior and the drivers that that can be found inside the ovation, within the cusp regions.
Like basically how the gases react with each other?
Right, how the gas, but also to how it relates to our magnetosphere.
Mm.
So we have the magnetic field to take in consideration. We have the charged particles within the ionosphere. We have the inherent radiation that's in our ionosphere. And how all those drivers contribute to understanding the nature of how that portion of our atmosphere behaves. And there's still quite a lot of science that has yet to determine what these factors are and what their relationships are. So I'm not saying that the research is in its infancy, but you know, it's science. We still don't know.
That's kind of exciting, though. It's like undiscovered.
There's a perfect example for that, actually. Just last year, through a citizen science network called Aurorasaurus, they had a researcher from Goddard Space Flight Center had started the citizen science network. And they basically had grouped individuals that would observe the auroras and their photographs to basically report through a downloadable app. And there was a couple photographs that some researchers had discovered, and they were asking the science community, which was on their Facebook page, as to exactly what is this. And so I don't know if you heard just recently, but this was a pretty interesting and new discovery, which is a charged emission line that looks like an aurora, but it's not. Hmm. And this was just discovered. And this was actually just proven,
It's a different
type of...
I guess, would you call it a strand? Or what would you call it?
They call it Steve.
Really? How about Eddie? So Eddie, when you went to where did you go? Alaska or
Fairbanks? Fairbanks.
Okay, Alaska. So you didn't see? Did you see it like at all?
It was very faint in the sky, but it was. I was there like early September, so you guys said October. I was there a little prematurely, but
did you hear anything, or was it just like
no? Didn't hear anything. Wow. Just saw a lot of Japanese tourists.
And it's not constant either.
No, it's not constant. It was there every night.
You know, the sun belches out this energy.
Yeah.
And then, so, I mean, it ebbs and flows. So you kind of have to get lucky.
Yeah.
A lot of people will go and try to see auroras on a trip. And
it seems like you have to be there for an extended period of time just to or just be lucky that it happens in the 2 or 3 days you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you like you just stay up all night and watch the sky.
Oh yeah,
yep,
yeah.
Minus 30, you can miss degrees. It within a couple seconds too, right?
No, actually.
Will it just kind of permeate the sky?
Depending on the visibility, in terms of clouds and whatnot and moonlight. But once an aurora comes, it stays around for a bit. Yeah. I mean, it really just depends a lot on the energetic flow. Mm-hmm. And but it's not like it just glances for a second.
And it wasn't like frantic energy. It's like it kind of dances.
At times it can be.
Wow.
Yeah. And we got our share.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be ethereal in one, moment, and then all of a sudden it'll just flash and shoot across the entire sky, and it's shocking.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's when you realize, okay, this is nature doing this,
right?
It blows the mind, especially when you realize what's happening, and this is all this energy being focused on the Earth, and basically the magnetosphere, as I understand it, is kind of deflecting a lot of this energy. And if it weren't for that, some bad things would probably happen.
Yeah, we'd all be dead.
Yeah, we don't need that.
Yeah.
So that coupled with our ionosphere, our atmosphere, there's just a lot of... It's definitely a very humbling experience to actually see it in action.
Yep.
To actually see a visible example, sampling of how this invisible protective layer works.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of the research that not just the United States, but also too throughout the entire world has concerns about understanding the fundamentals of our ionosphere and also to our magnetosphere process as to how we are protected, but also to how, as a direct effect, particularly on our GPS,
Yeah.
Satellites.
Well, I mean, yeah, if the poles flipped, we'd be...
Well, that's...
we'd be screwed.
Yeah, that's one thing to consider, but also, too, that there is also research that's been... some findings that oxygen is actually escaping our ionosphere.
Really?
Yeah. Not that it's going to affect us, but it's interesting.
It affects that, I'm sure.
It's an interesting discovery. And the fact that our sun's process, as our Earth rotates from day to night, two completely different, some very interesting behavior. Our ionosphere actually thins out, gets thinner.
When the sun's not directly hitting it?
Right.
So when it is, it strengthens itself.
It's almost like it's breathing. Yeah.
Interesting.
And then also, too, there's extreme heating that's being emitted from the regions where the magnetosphere and the ionosphere couple. And they call it neutral upwelling. And this heating that emanates from these particular areas, when satellites pass by, it creates a drag. And so we're talking about satellites that we rely on for GPS coordinates and calibration. And if those things slow down, it throws us off. But also, too, it interferes or interrupts their flight, their sustainability for orbit.
It pulls them in. It can pull them in, right?
Sure. Yeah. Slows them down, pulls them in a little bit.
Yep.
They need fuel to get back on track and their velocity. And so
that's crazy.
Yeah, so there's, and then also, too, we have gamma radiation coming from wherever, interstellar.
Yeah, that's what made the Hulk.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're still trying to comprehend as far as how, to the extent of the protection that the ionosphere is providing for us.
And are there any universities in, like, University of Reykjavik?
Mm-hmm.
Don't they have a program that kind of focuses on some of the studies of that, or they just haven't been involved in this project at all?
Reykjavik University is predominantly in engineering.
Okay.
When we were there, the University of Iceland has a very strong astrophysics department there, and
I've got a few friends from Iceland. They're like, it happens. It's like a very common thing to them. And it has this mystical legend that I've been hearing about. I've never seen it. It's always been on my bucket list.
That's like what I feel about when I live in New York and goes, Statue of Liberty.
it's just this green piece of copper. So, Eddie, would you go and see it now, or did you not get a good experience when you saw it?
I barely saw it. I could see there was something up there, mm-hmm. like waving mm-hmm. around, but that I couldn't. The colors were not vibrant or anything like that. It wasn't like I was not in shock.
What you're saying is you're not ready to make a documentary about it.
No, I don't know if I'll make a special trip to see it again. If I happen to be around the area when it happens, I'll look up. But I don't know. I'm just not a big traveler. So.
Were you in Fairbanks proper?
Yeah. So there's probably a lot of
light pollution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have to go out to the sticks.
Yep.
Definitely.
It helps.
The icy
sticks. It's recommended. Yeah. The further out, the better.
And as far as the footage, mm-hmm. how much have you combed through? Have you combed through all the footage you have so far?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And we have a production coming up from... we're going to be joining our partner university and the RockSat-X team, and they're going to be launching a payload into the auroras from Andøya, Norway, which is high up in the latitudes. And
you guys going there for that?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's going to be it's quite spectacular terrain.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really that's something wild. Else. Yeah.
What's the coolest footage that you've been able to acquire from this experience?
Like, do you have that hero shot yet?
Real-time auroras bursting overhead.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, real-time.
Yeah.
You know, just 5 years ago, we weren't able to look at footage unless it was time-lapse of an aurora.
Video cameras weren't low-light capable enough to
capture
it. Oh. And
what's the speed of the light, like the... the visual? Is it like a quick flash, or is it kind of like this hue that kind of surrounds the shot?
I think for the most part, it's just imagine if you were an ant lying down on your back and a sliding door window was open and you were looking up at curtains.
That's awesome.
It's an interesting way to put it.
He's like, I know what you speak of.
And you're blasting lasers on the curtains.
And the sky's having a Star War.
That's crazy.
And there's a green neon light blinking at it.
Yeah. Oh, and then you fire a rocket up into it. That was also spectacular.
Yeah.
We got to see rockets launch into active aurora.
Was there a reaction to it when the rockets would go into it? Was there a visible reaction?
No.
No? It just goes into it?
He's nodding. He's like, yeah. You were on a different drug.
Yeah, not from the rocket itself.
No, we have a caller.
No.
Oh.
Let's see what that's about. Hello. Hello. You're on Wake Up Hollywood.
Hi, this is Susie Kim. How are you?
Hey, Susie, how are you?
I called it.
I'm good. I'm listening to you guys, and I don't know if they're capable, but they should show you guys the footage of the aurora overhead.
Oh, sure, yeah. Show us the footage. Thanks, Susie. That's what we need. Susie,
hello?
You were supposed to send these before this.
Show us the footage. Why are you guys holding out? Jeepers.
Aren't you in an airplane? How can you be calling us?
Susie, you've been awesome in coordinating this. I've been so excited for this interview for weeks. Just
really?
So you know. Oh yeah.
I know. Seriously. You guys are the best. Thank you so much. Your patience has been amazing.
I'm so excited. And I didn't even know oh my God, I could see a glimpse of this footage. Susie, I'm so glad you called right now.
I know. Okay, just watch the footage. Great interview, you guys.
Oh, wow. That's
big
crazy.
Love.
All right, are we picking you up later? She's off.
Eddie, quit hogging the footage, man.
It was crazy. Is that that's the rocket going in, right?
That's actually a sounding rocket, and that's
can I see it real quick
for them to test the winds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
To measure the winds and in preparation for the rocket launch.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's insane. Is wild.
Yeah. So that's all real time.
And to see it, like, in person, when you can look horizon to horizon, unbelievable. It's kind of it's mind altering.
Oh my God, Eddie, you got to see this shot.
Yeah, I see it,
dude. That's wild.
Yeah.
Does it reflect light onto the ground, or is it not? Is it just moonlight, or is there actually see like a light show on the ground?
You can see it because we were on snow.
Right, because the white should
the winter.
Reflect,
it
right?
It was January, and we were standing on snow the whole time. So, it does, but
wow.
I mean...
That's nuts.
I don't know why you'd be looking
down. No, I'm just wondering if it projects light down like that.
It does.
Well, it's like
it was intense enough when we were there. I guess we got really, really lucky in terms of the intensity. There were people that worked... at Poker Flat that said, I've never seen an aurora this intense, and I've been here for 20 years. Right.
That's lucky.
Yeah.
Wow.
Beginner's luck, I guess.
Any kind of luck's good luck.
Yeah.
That is incredible footage. You're about to show us some more. I can see.
Oh, yeah. Here's the rocket.
That's
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Oh, my God.
That was a magical night.
Mm. Holy shit.
Yeah, that's a money shot.
Dude, that's awesome.
So you guys just did shrooms and laid there? And looked up?
Damn, I wish.
No comment.
Yeah, no comment.
You know what's
there's
crazy?
Too much camera equipment to operate.
It almost looks like smoke and water and light just kind of dancing in the sky.
Yeah.
But what's crazy is how it kind of moves and reacts to itself.
Yeah.
That's the craziest. I've only seen little clips here and there, nothing like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's been on my bucket list forever, but that's incredible.
Yeah, you should join us in Norway.
Yeah, you let me know. You can definitely see it when you go to Norway.
And then you could try to figure out the words to explain it.
Right.
I'll probably do it with music. That's all I can do. Mm-hmm. Eddie's like, nah, I'll think of a good joke. I'll make a come back joke from Norway. So have you seen it in Norway? Or not yet?
Not yet.
I know you're going
to. We shall be, yeah.
So you've only seen it in Iceland, and you've seen it in Alaska. Or have you also seen it in Alaska?
Yeah, he was in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
And what was your preference?
Well, another thing to think about here is the auroras in Alaska are different from the auroras in Europe.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that has to do with day and night side. The way our Earth is slightly tilted during the winter, and there's just and also too, if you were to think about the way that the Earth is tilted in the winter, away from the sun,
mm-hmm.
The magnetic field has a different penetration point.
Right.
So you have energy coming from the sun into. Oh, it's really hard for me to explain
that. Yeah, the angle that it's.
Yeah.
No, I totally get what you're saying. Yeah.
It's coming like this. I'm like,
yeah.
So there's two different types of aurora processes, given that the tilt axis of our Earth within a given time of the year, which let's just say this in the winter, optimum time for North America or Northern Hemisphere to see it. So you have energetic particles that fall right into the magnetic field lines on the face, and then you have energetic particles that stream down into the magnetic field, the tail, because consider like a bow wake. So it's pressing, mm-hmm. the energy is pressing our deforming our magnetic field. And there's this reconnection that happens at the tail.
Yeah, it's going around it and then coming.
Right. And then there's like a short at the end,
right,
the tail, and that's where the charged particles get trapped and then follow the field lines back onto the night side.
Man, you should do this premiere at the dome in Griffith Observatory, man.
Well, that's what the intent of the final film would be for science theaters, IMAX, so to speak. And it's basically oriented for that of educational science centers.
So, man, that's wicked.
It'll be both, IMAX and Dome.
Please invite us to those.
Absolutely.
So, Eddie, you asked this. What's the timetable you think? You obviously have a lot of footage that's amazing. How are you going to choose what shots? That's going to be the hardest part,
I think. Yeah. So, much of this decision is to allow for the story to basically finish with the footage from the perspective of our payload camera.
Yeah, we need to get the camera inside. Into it.
That's the whole point, right?
That's the
thing that no one else has gotten was the shot inside.
That's right.
Yeah. That was the whole purpose. And again, there's a lot of factors involved that dictate our time. So,
it's an expensive trip just for one person, let alone all crew. Yeah.
But it's also too, we have to justify and get awarded to either piggyback or to be on a designated payload for a flight into the auroras. And there's probably only three places that NASA launches from, and also too, recovering the data.
Hmm.
It's not something that you can downstream.
Right.
Because it's quite a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah, it's probably massive.
Yeah.
We got to go hunt the payload down.
Yeah. So, points from Poker Flat, yes, it would land, but it would land in the wilderness. And not exactly, it's accurate. Not a permissible landscape to just let me just get on my snowmobile and then we'll just go track it and find it.
Right.
And then, from Andøya or Svalbard, that's an archipelago north of Norway, they just land in the North Sea, in the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah, in the Arctic.
How would you get it out of there?
Don't know yet.
Yeah, we're starting brainstorming on that.
Deadliest catch.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
So it'll happen when it happens, is what you're saying.
It'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're already halfway there. You already got
Yeah, we're, I, the I'd most say so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
And we have some wonderful advisors. And I just can't speak more highly of the individuals that we've introduced to the project that are rooting for us, particularly the folks from NASA Wallops, the scientific community within the Sounding Rocket program, and all of the students. Just wonderful.
And are you measuring sound just with the camera, or are you also sending up microphones?
Well, technically speaking, you're in space.
So there's no sound.
There's no sound in vacuum. But it doesn't rule it out. I'd certainly be interested to have some type of a different sensitivity of a spectrum of a microphone to be able to pick up any type of audibility up there. I think it would actually be very interesting. But I'm sure someone has attempted studies on that. I'm not one to know. Yeah. But if there was an opportunity and there was a researcher there that said otherwise, I would totally jump on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it has a sound.
It looks like it has a sound.
I know it sounds strange, but...
Yeah.
Because just the... Like, I'm a musician, so everything to me is about rhythm and flow and tempo.
Right. Yeah.
And it has all of that.
Yeah.
So if it has all of that, to me, it would have some kind of vibration...
Yeah.
Murmur something, because there. I think that it would influence the way it moves,
right,
in addition to the gases and, you know, how they react to each other.
And there's a lot of mythology and people that claim they've heard it.
Right, of course.
But it's never been recorded.
Measured, yeah. That's
so
the hardest part.
It's never been proven. So.
Yeah, I mean, the names escape me, but there are researchers out there that have devices... and my colleague Eric, who's a heavy audio sound enthusiast, and he's been doing that aspect of research to see if there was any type of instrumentation that we could actually complement our payload.
Has NASA said that any astronauts and things, if they've seen it happening as it's happening?
As far as the audio...
No, no, I'm talking about the visuals. Like,
oh, yeah.
You can see it from space.
There's plenty of footage taken from the astronauts over in the ISS, and also, too, from Space Shuttle at the time. But they're constantly going over both north and southern, or what's called the Aurora Australis in the southern hemisphere.
Who knew you'd be painting one day and then know so much about auroras?
Yeah.
Has it made you paint?
I still need to learn a lot more. Yes, I'm still painting.
That's fantastic. Well, gentlemen, where can we expect to see the movie? Are you looking for a release through, besides the science theaters and IMAX, are you looking for a network or something like a Discovery Channel or something like that?
Yeah, there's we're in the makings of a series for delivering through like Hulu, Netflix, maybe.
Fantastic.
Discovery.
Yeah, so there'll be one deliverable will be a small screen docu-series, and then we'll have the giant screen educational.
And the Griffith Observatory Dome Planetarium showing.
That's right.
That's what it needs. I mean, that footage is just aching for that.
Yeah, we have a virtual reality component.
Yeah.
You know, for both experiential and educational purposes.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, you're on the cutting edge.
Yeah.
Man, what an interesting story. We wish you guys such a great voyage to finish this. Don't stop. Don't stop. You're halfway there at least.
Can't stop.
Maybe more. Yeah. Maybe 70, 80%, right? And if you need an editor, Eddie's here for you.
I don't have the equipment to do that. I can hook you up with a mushroom guy.
Equipment or patience, because there's going to be a lot of shots of nothing that you have to go through too, right?
Yeah, I would imagine.
Wow. He's your guy.
No, I'm not your guy.
Well, Susie Kim, I'm glad you were listening. And thanks for urging us to see the footage. The footage is remarkable. And guys, Matt Hines, we're just in awe. It's going to be exciting.
Wow,
to see
thanks for having us.
Of course, very you guys were wonderful. You guys got to come back and keep us posted on this.
Absolutely.
I want to see this thing.
We'll have you at the premiere.
It's a promise. Yes, a promise.
Absolutely.
You heard it here first.
Hopefully not frostbitten.
Yeah. Wear mittens.
We'll stay warm. On behalf of Eddie and I, we'll see you guys next week.
Matt.